You can find it, the entire episode, at kbo.fm/healthwatch. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine. Next up is Madness Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Identities and Futures. Women and non-binary folks speak out March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Holocene in Portland. Identities and Futures is an evening of performances, animation, and DJs, including DJ Kim Fizzy, Lily Croft, Gene Etheridge, Pocha Radicales, and more. Again, that's Identities and Futures, Women and Non-Binary Folks Speak Out, March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Holocene. 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Nirali Shah. Nirali teaches Buddhist meditation and is a certified mindfulness facilitator from UCLA's Mindful Awareness Research Center. She lives in the Bay Area, California, and her teaching currently includes Google as well as Insight Meditation Center and Spirit Rock. Nirali has worked in slum communities in Asia for more than 4 years around social change. So welcome to Madness Radio, Nirali Shah.
Hi, delighted to be here.
It's really my honor to have you on the show. And we're going to be talking about meditation and also maybe some things that aren't talked about so much with meditation, the sort of the darker side or the shadow side. Then what was the thing that got you interested in becoming a meditator? Because you've been practicing meditation for many, many years, yeah?
Yeah, I think the most vivid memory I have is maybe being around 9 or 10 years old and having this going into long periods of the day where I'm just like observing my thoughts and my emotions, and then I would write about it. And that was so important to me. And then over time, when I was 19 or something, I started like getting more curious about it and started sitting a lot of retreats in my 20s. And then I've been, I guess, formally on this path for about 10 or 15 years now.
You started practicing in the Theravadin mindfulness tradition. And how did that benefit you? What was it that happened next?
So what's really interesting is when you go into a lot of these retreats, one thing that starts happening is your ideas of rights and wrongs start dissolving. And so the inner critic or the judge starts sort of softening. And that's very, very powerful, because then you don't have a center. You know, there isn't one center around which everything has to revolve.
So break that down for us. How is it that meditation could be useful to help us to not be so harsh on ourselves and to not judge ourselves? What exactly does that look like?
So a lot of this practice is a very body-based practice, and that's the most important thing that I love about this practice. I mean, if there is a number one thing in my life that I feel has been most precious in my entire life, I would say it's this capacity to be in my body and to sense and feel my body in a very, very deep way. So where the mind is not that active, but the wisdom of the body is arising and it's guiding my life. as you practice more, you are entering the space of equanimity. And equanimity is like non-judgment. And that's such a sacred space to start entering in your body through equanimity. So it creates so much spaciousness in your being. And equanimity is not possible without compassion. So there's a lot of compassion and loving presence that you're offering yourself. And as you do that, it's interesting. The mind stops becoming active, but there is a different quality of wisdom or insight that arises, which is not necessarily very cognitive, but it still has like a very powerful sort of voice in it. And for me, what happened was so one of the things that started happening is I went to a retreat, and it was so clear that I'm supposed to leave everything, quit my job, quit everything, sell everything, and go to India. And I ended up going and serving in a slum community for several years. And also, like, I started realizing that connection to the earth is so important. And so after working in the slums, I spent more than a year living at farms and with tribal communities, sometimes in forest communities, just spending more time in nature and doing organic farming.
So your life had lost its meaning, and then you used meditation to kind of re-examine what your assumptions were.
I might have thought in my head that, okay, I'm going to stay in the U.S. and get a mortgage and more student loans and get married and have children and buy a bunch of cars and more houses. And that's not really what my spirit wanted. My spirit wanted to be in the slums, and it wanted to be in the forest, and it wanted to be at meditation retreats. And so I feel immensely grateful that I could give myself that gift of time and space to really listen deeply to my body.
This is extremely important, and it intersects so much with what we talk about on Madness Radio from Jungian psychology and from ecological perspectives, because what you're describing is that the suffering is really a conflict between what your deeper self, your spirit, wants, and then kind of what your ego or your personality or the conditioning is telling you. And if that conflict gets strong enough, you will start to get depressed, or you'll start to get symptoms, or you get anxious, or maybe even you go into madness, or you go into psychosis, because the spirit sort of rebels. And then if you use a tool like mindfulness to kind of slow down, to step back and re-examine some of these automatic, repetitive, conditioned responses, then you'd start to discover that actually the conditioning that you had, who you think you were, actually there's something different. And then you can start to align more with what your spirit is seeking. And so in a sense, the symptom or the crisis or the depression in your experience is kind of like a messenger from the spirit. It's the spirit saying, hey, wait a second. I don't have the words to explain it to you right now, but all I can do is kind of put on the emergency brakes, bring this to a halt, and then hopefully force you to re-examine your assumptions and find a different direction for your life.
What you're saying is so powerful. You know, it reminds me of something that one of my mentors, who's now like 95 years old, and he's a Gandhian, and he went to prison during the British freedom fight, and he's a very, 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 very inspiring human being. And one thing he told me, which I find has been one of the most precious teachings that he offered me in my life, was he said that there's something very, very sacred and tender inside each one of us. And our only work in life is to take care of that tender sacredness that's inside us. And what happens because of just the way our in modern world, the way we are raised and education and all of that, is that we end up like forgetting that. And we take in the ideas and thoughts of the world into our mind stream. And that starts dictating what we should be, or what we should look like, or what we should do or not do. And that's so heavy. taking in all this information from the world and not examining it, and just then subconsciously believing it, you know, and those turn into voices in our head. They turn into the inner critic, and that starts creating a lot of violence and chaos in our lives.
And I think what you're describing is really a rewilding process, that that gentle, soft part of ourselves that we need to pay attention to inside of us that your teacher was telling you about, that's really the wild part. And that wild part we've become disconnected from because we're domesticated, we're conditioned, we're trained into being a certain way in society. You can't express, you can't be this, you can't connect in a certain way. And that really cuts off that wild part. And so in a sense, it's an ecological imperative. And the tool that we have for many people, this has been a very useful tool, is meditation and mindfulness to re-examine that conditioning and then give some space to listen to other parts of us and maybe become more of an integrated being that's more in touch with its animal nature, that's more in touch with its wild nature.
Wow, it's so incredible you say that, because I'm giving a talk at Google next week and the title of the talk is Meditation for Rewilding Yourself. So, you're like spot on. I think there is something very, very primal, almost like a deeper nature spirit in each one of us. And it is hard to constrain that spirit through Google calendars and, you know, mortgages and taxes and bills. And, you know, none of us are actually set up internally to function stress-free in that system, actually. And so that spirit inside us wants to express itself, and the expression is not going to, it's going to be very unique. And I think the idea around meditation is to really, really get in touch with that. I mean, if you had met me 15 years ago, you would have met a very, very different Nirali, who was tired and who was, you know, weighed down and who didn't feel this level of vibrancy and aliveness and sort of strength and power in her body. And that has so much to do with that spirit being really oppressed in so many ways.
And I think that spirit often expresses itself in the form of some kind of what psychiatry calls a symptom, or some kind of disturbance, or some condition or syndrome or something that we then pathologize because we're trying to domesticate it. What about someone who would make an assumption that, okay, meditation is about stopping my thoughts? And I tried that. I sat down, I meditated, I couldn't stop my thoughts, and therefore meditation doesn't work for me because I can't do it.
That touches upon kind of the shadow side of the way meditation is thought. A lot of meditation in our world has been co-opted by the system to make us feel even more domesticated. There's a lack of vitality and feeling. So I think meditation becomes a way of disassociation from feelings, instead of getting even more sort of into the rich soil of things, you know. So there's a way meditation can become very dry, basically.
So would you say that it's really about everybody's individual way of finding their own path for mindfulness and awareness?
Yeah, I mean, I would say sitting meditation is not right for everyone at all times. Meditation happens in so many ways. We are all sort of in a wave. Sometimes we are going up, sometimes we are in the middle, sometimes we are down. And meditation is essentially, no matter where I am on the wave in any particular day, how am I meeting myself? And am I meeting myself with compassion?
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is Nirali Shah. She's a Buddhist meditation teacher and certified mindfulness facilitator from UCLA's Mindful Awareness Research Center. She lives in the Bay Area, California, and her teaching currently includes Google, as well as Insight Meditation Center and Spirit Rock. Nirali has worked in slum communities in Asia for more than 4 years around social change. Do you think that sometimes the meditation, especially as it's practiced in the West and the United States, has just become another individualist tool, another sort of consumerist pleasure for finding relaxation, and people are really avoiding responsibilities of oppression and social justice and getting involved and engaged in the world?
All right. You're touching a very sensitive nerve here. Yeah, there's no doubt. Meditation has been co-opted in a way for us to be more productive and more sort of manageable cogs in this larger machinery. And I mean, if we are looking at meditation as just a way of reducing stress and anxiety so that we can function more normally in the way the world wants us to function, then yeah, I don't know. I feel meditation can do more harm even. It can be very disassociative from our feelings and create a sense of apathy to our own feelings, our own needs, our own emotions, and apathy towards the world. So people sometimes misunderstand being calm and relaxed and still as being disassociated or apathetic. And I've seen that both. I mean, I've been to meditation retreats where people are meditating for 30 years, but somehow it's very hard for them to really feel all the rich compost of emotions that is moving inside them.
I also think that sometimes Westerners will look at an Asian culture and just romanticize it and say, wow, isn't Tibet wonderful? Isn't Hinduism wonderful? And we sort of pulled it up in a pedestal because we feel like we're lacking deep spiritual traditions that nourish us on a daily level. And so we romanticize and we exoticize, and then we don't see that, hey, there's oppression and sexism and racism and exploitation in those cultures as well. I mean, we tend to just want to, you know, hold it up in this romantic image, which is in itself is a kind of colonialism and a kind of racism, because it denies the shared humanity.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you're bringing up this piece, because it's not fair to create this idyllic idea of what these cultures are like. And in the Theravada tradition, for example, women, if you're a woman nun, you're not allowed to be fully ordained. So essentially, you are not allowed to teach in a way, and you're always kind of a bit subservient to the male monks. And there are some women who broke those rules, and in these last 20 years, like, they have been, they're fully ordained in the Thai tradition. But I mean, I heard a few months back, there was a bombing in a monastery, a nunnery, because these women were getting fully ordained. So there are all kinds of things happening, even in these extremely religious settings. And so we have to be careful and find our own, have our own compass, inner compass to guide us.
So how can meditation and mindfulness contribute to the struggle against social injustice? Is it more than just, you know, being calm and relaxed when you go to the protest?
So this is so important, because this is a topic that doesn't get spoken enough in the meditation world, is that how can you teach meditation without a deep understanding and a deep dialogue around social justice and systemic oppressions? Because some people, the way they teach meditation, it's I mean, the way I have heard it in certain cultures is that it turns into this kind of a transcendent practice where there's something wrong with the world, there's a lot of suffering in the world, and I'm supposed to transcend and go into nirvana, go somewhere else, so that I don't have to feel the difficulties and stress of this world. And so hopefully everyone will go to nirvana at some point. And so, we won't have people suffering in this world. That's one viewpoint. As I have been practicing, and I had that viewpoint too when I started off. And over the years, what has changed for me is that I feel a deep connection with this absolute reality where there are states which are very, very powerful. And over time, when you are practicing, you do experience mental and emotional states and even states which are beyond sort of the mind-matter phenomena. And they're very wholesome and nourishing states, and they're hard to even talk about because language is limiting. But what happened for me more and more as I experienced these states is actually the desire to come fully in my body on earth in this reality. So I feel more connected to reality and Mother Earth than I ever did before. And I feel like there is a desire to understand that in order to be free in my existence on earth, it's important to understand all the ways in which freedom has been curbed, freedom has been taken away. And so I feel way more present than I ever did around freedom, around being a gender freedom, or freedom around race, or economic oppression, or all of these different types of oppression are like so much more alive for me today than they have ever been. And I can see how they have a huge role to play. So I cannot go, I cannot have a corporate where I'm teaching meditation, but in that corporation, we are not talking about economic oppression. If in that corporation, we are not talking about race and gender and all of these things, like if we are, or like sexual orientation and the freedom around gender orientation, like if we are not talking about that along with meditation, then I don't know how are we talking about deeper awareness and freedom.
So when people hear that you're teaching at Google, you're not just teaching, you know, sort of like the kind of meditation that one might stereotype think is being taught at Google, which is how to work harder and, you know, not complain about it. You're teaching a very different kind of meditation.
Yeah, this is so important because the way it's understood is that as you meditate, you will have less stress. My experience is that in some ways that is true, but in some ways a lot of deep stuff around the ways you have oppressed your spirit will come up to the surface. And that probably would be a bit of a stressful situation to enter. So it's not going to be complete stress reduction so that I can be more productive and create more Excel sheets. What's going to probably happen is you might have to take time off. You might have to go away for a month and just sit with yourself because some deep stuff will get unearthed.
I'm so glad you're talking about this because, I mean, meditation is a tool and it's a powerful tool, and any tool can be used destructively as well as constructively, because when you meditate, you can learn to start taming your emotions and controlling through breath control and through, you know, letting your feelings pass. You can learn to start shutting yourself down and bypass the experiences that you're going through. But what you're talking about is really the opposite about that, really embracing the wildness and the out of control nature of whatever it is that's coming. Because again, don't want to just, you know, dive into this and discover that you have this powerful tool and then not how to know how to use it in a useful way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of spiritual bypassing that happens through meditation. And I think that's one of the things you want to be most careful about.
When you say spiritual bypass, what do you mean?
Pretty much what you said right now. I mean, spiritual bypass shows up in so many different ways. But one way is that you start controlling your emotions. So you start seeing as emotions as a problem, and you feel that if you're getting intense, even spiritual experiences, there might be something wrong with you. And so you, because you have this map of what spiritual progress looks like, map that has been created by someone. And so you want to live up to that map. So the word skillfulness comes up a lot in this practice, is around how do you skillfully hold all these emotions. And essentially, all these decades of practice is for you to learn skillfulness around holding that. And also, it's important to offer the other side of it, like meditation or any of these practices doesn't give you a license to go around exuding, expressing your emotions out into the world in ways that are like harmful. So I think
some meditation teachers have taken to an extreme. They get very into power trips and they think that they are enlightened, so therefore they are beyond good and evil and they can just set the rules and then be very abusive to the people in the hierarchy under them. So it can be very dangerous if you see it as a license or a permission in that way.
And for me, like, a lot of this practice has so much to do with delight. Like, a lot of this practice is taking, you know, even at retreats, like I'm meditating for several hours and say intense, strong emotions are showing up. I'm not going to work through them at that point. I'm going to actually, those emotions came up, they're not going to go anywhere. But in fact, instead of meditating, I'm going to go out for a really nice walk, or I'm going to have a nice cup of tea. I'm going to smell the flowers. I'm going to hang out with the deer. And so there's a lot around taking in delight and experiencing this beauty of being in this human form.
Which is so simple. I mean, I think that's one of the greatest gifts of awareness and mindfulness and meditation, is it sensitizes us to just the simple beauty and joy that we can have just from a cup of tea or just being able to see a sunset.
I mean, for me, the question that is alive is bringing this sense of stability and restedness in the practice. The practice is also not about go, 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 you know. The practice is very restful. So I think one misconception that sometimes we have in this practice is that the more I meditate, the more years of meditation I do, my life is going to become better. And I have some good news and bad news. And that is that your life may not necessarily change. I mean, when I even hear about the life of the Buddha after he became enlightened, his life had so many problems up until 80 or something till he lived. Like, there were so many chaotic events and scandals and all kinds of things that were happening in his life. And his life was not like perfect or smooth. And I think this practice is not about figuring out or fixing or solving something that is broken. This practice is actually your capacity for being with randomness and uncertainty.
Nirali, we are just about out of time. Let us know how people can get in touch with you.
Thank you so much, Will. This has been a lot of fun chatting with you. And you can get more information about the work I'm doing or get in touch with me if you have any questions on my website. And that is www.nirals, which is nirals.com.
Nirali Shah, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Nirali Shah. She teaches Buddhist meditation and is a certified mindfulness facilitator from UCLA's Mindful Awareness Research Center. She lives in the Bay Area, California, and her teaching currently includes Google, as well as Insight Meditation Center and Spirit Rock. Nirali has worked in slum communities in Asia for more than 4 years around social change. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
No March Madness here for us, but we do have our very own special bracket that we want you, the listeners of KBOO, to be part of. We'll be celebrating the melancholy March sadness this month, and we'd like you to contribute some music.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So just go to the KBOO website and search Diablo Sadness, enter some songs, and then come back later to vote. We'll be broadcasting the winners on March 24th.
Sounds like she's having a good time.
She's crying. It's backwards. Sort of makes me sad when I hear it. Sounds like she's laughing, doesn't it?
KBOO.
And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. It's noon. And it's time for the headline news.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, March 6, 2017. In local news, the Latino community organization Hispanic Voice for Community Change is holding a rally today at 4:30 p.m. outside the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement offices to protest what they are calling a campaign of terror. The protesters are asking Mayor Ted Wheeler and the Portland City Council to declare the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, called ICE for short, not welcome in the city of Portland. The protest will be held at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement offices located at 4310 Southwest McAdam Avenue. The rally comes amidst recently released documents showing that Multnomah County Sheriff's deputies have been working with ICE agents to apprehend and deport undocumented immigrants. While the documents obtained under a Freedom of Information Act show the collusion between federal ICE agents and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, current